Does anybody have their questions written down that we can pass up? Okay. How can our movement work to erase our differences and combine our numbers to gain political power, acceptance, and validation in the United States?
Ooh.
And 1 minute.
Okay. First of all, I'm thrilled by the ambition of the question. Yeah. I think that the answer is not always to do the thing that is most pleasing. I think that the women's movement in general and the anti-battery movement have the respect that we have, which is really quite considerable. If you think about what people expect from us, expect us to be able to accomplish, because we take stands on principle and because we help women in their real lives. And I don't think that we should be afraid of social conflict. And I don't think that we should be afraid of the names that we're called and the edge of social reaction that often strikes us back, you know, politically. It is terrible to have to go through it, but I think we have to be realistic about social change. And social change involves conflict. We're talking about changing something very big and very deep here. It really hasn't been challenged before. The first wave of feminists wanted very much, if you read their private correspondence, they wanted so much to really be able to talk about marriage, and in particular sexual relations in marriage and battery in public. But they knew that they would be excoriated for doing so, and that the possibility of getting the vote would simply vanish. We have the vote. We've had it for a while. Many of us would argue we haven't made very good use of it. I think that we have to take every opportunity that we have to talk about the real things, and that's how social change happens. And we have differences among ourselves, and we have to talk about those too. In the last 20 years, I've gotten more worried about lying for the sake of social acceptance than I have about letting people see our conflicts. So I keep thinking that common sense plays a role here in how we talk about all of these issues. But I am going to tell you that I don't think that we can make a difference in terms of ending battery or ending rape or ending prostitution, and that's my agenda, that's what I believe in. We can't do those things if we don't talk about the real stuff.
Okay, here's another easy one. What do we do with the knowledge that many, many batterers are adult battered children? What do we do with the perpetrator / victim? The intergenerational abuse of male children as well as female children?
Yeah. Those are two separate questions, and it's important, I think, to keep them separate because we are at this moment in time. And at this moment in time, there are boys who are being victimized, who are being incestuously abused, who are being raped, who are being forced into prostitution. All those things are happening to boys as well as girls. I will tell you that the deeper and wider pornography gets, the more boys will be hurt. Since nobody appears to give a damn about the numbers of women who are being hurt, the pornographers really do encourage incest. They really do promote it. They think it's a really good thing. So accepting pornography sets boys up for abuse, and that's important to understand. I have a lot of trouble with the first part of the question, which has to do with those who are perpetrators who were victims of battery when they were children. There are things to say about it that I think are valuable. One is, many of them were hurt by their fathers. A fair number of them were hurt by their mothers. It is important, I think, for women not to have to marry and not to have to have children. And I'm talking about the social imperatives here. I'm not talking about the strategies for achieving that. I'm talking about the social demand that women don't really exist as citizens whom we have to respect if they're not married and with children. I think that we have to do everything we can to cut down the violence wherever it comes from inside the family. But then when we talk about the adult male perpetrator, this is where I, as somebody who has had the experience of being battered, I go blank. Because I don't know any solution except jail. Women who have killed in self-defense, I think it's important to support them. I think it's important politically to support battered women who kill the men who are hurting them. We haven't found ways of changing men who hurt women, whether they're batterers or rapists or whether they rape children. We haven't found ways of making them different. And so the only recourse that we have is to take them away from the rest of us and try to make the kinds of social changes that won't produce them in the first place. And I think that's just realistic. Not happy making, but realistic.
What do you do with the phenomenon of battering between women in lesbian relationships?
It's very important that it be acknowledged and addressed. I think that the crisis that it presents for the women's movement, frankly, is not in terms of the partner who's being battered, it's in terms of the partner who's doing the battering, which very little attention has been being paid to. You know, when we talk about male violence, many of us have said over and over and over and over again, we don't think that we're talking about any kind of biological inevitability. That's why we believe that this can be changed through social means, through changing society. It is not surprising to find that there are women who are violent in relationships if you look at violence as a function of power over another human being. And I think that that's part of the importance of including lesbian battering in everything that we do, because it reminds us of that, also because of the importance of the lives of the women that are being destroyed. And maybe this is a bridge in some way to the last question, to try to find solutions that will in fact change the behavior of the batterer. I'm not sure.
How can you talk to a battered woman about her wanting to go back?
It's unbelievably difficult, as you know. And the reason is that her fear of the batterer is so incredibly deep that she can't express it to you. She can't tell you that you think it's magical and irrational, but she knows it's not. He is going to find her. He is going to hurt her. It is going to happen, and the only chance she has in the world is to try to propitiate him in some way or another. And the thing that's so shocking about this is that, you know, battered women who can will tell you that the man is going to kill them after they've left. And people treat it as if it's illogical and irrational. And as I say, now we have 10 years of some experience in dealing with women who have been battered, and we know that more women are killed after they leave than when they stay, percentage-wise. So it's the truth. It's the truth that she's in terrible, terrible danger when she leaves. And if you can't give her safety, you can't give her a reason not to go back, because she has a sudden perception that he's going to kill her, and she's probably right. It's horrible. And What are we talking about here? We're talking about a form of abuse that as long as people continue to tolerate it, there really isn't going to be any solution that we can call a real escape. And so that's part of the reason that I'm suggesting to you. At some point, the woman will decide that she'd rather, and this is horrible, she will decide that she'd rather be dead. And at the point that she decides that she would rather be dead, it is very likely that that is when she will really leave and stay away. And then there's the chance that she will really be dead.
What do you believe the effect of the far right to be on present and future U.S. society? I refer to Falwell, Phyllis Schlafly, the Buchanans, etc.
I'd like to answer it in relation to Battery, if I could, to try to focus it in that way. Several years ago, maybe it was 10 years ago, in New Hampshire, the Committee on the Status of Women was taken over by this particular political faction. And women were labeled by the state of New Hampshire. Women who ran away were labeled, the way that slaves used to be labeled when they ran away. And they were fugitives. They were punitively labeled by the state for deserting their families. And we were told that Battery wasn't a real thing, and that these women weren't escaping, but that instead what we were dealing with was a feminist plot, again, to destroy the family. I think that most of us know that Battery takes place along the whole political spectrum, as all these crimes against women do. All right, and the left has their way of protecting the men who commit the crimes, and the right has their way of protecting the men who commit the crimes. And I think that where I see all of us as having to stand up against what I would call the far right ideology is in this, that no woman should give a superior value to her family than to her own life. That if the family cannot accommodate the safety and dignity of women, that particular family should not exist as a family. And we have to make it possible for women to live on our own, with our children, in conditions of safety, until maybe men find a way to live without hurting us.
Okay, one last question. How can we stop pornography through policy and legislation and also protect the First Amendment freedom of speech?
It's a very important question. As many of you will know, Catherine McKinnon, who's a constitutional lawyer, and myself, who's a citizen, drafted a model form of civil rights legislation in the city of Minneapolis, a very progressive city, in which there was a very concrete and specific definition of pornography, and then civil causes of action, so that if a woman were coerced into pornography, she could sue whoever had coerced her, but also the whole chain of profit. With pornography, we're almost always talking about organized crime, at least in the distribution, now that we have more amateurs actually making the product. And you will see pornography being made of battered women. You will see this as part of sexual abuse inside homes now. I think that our civil rights bill is the best way to approach the pornography industry and at the same time respect the rights of political expression, literary expression, and sexual expression. Now, in order to believe that, you have to think that sex is not inherently brutalizing of women. If you think that pornography is in fact simply one part of sex, and if you think that, for instance, male domination is part of sex, then you're going to believe that anything that's done against pornography is something that's going to be done against sexual expression. But if you're fighting for a world in which there's equality and in which sex has something to do with not just expression but communication, then it seems to me that if we hold the pornographers responsible for the harms that they do to women, and we can have women who are hurt go into court and get money damages, since money is all the pornographers care about, we can significantly at least reduce the reach of the pornography industry in this country. And I have to say to you that when incest and homelessness join up with female poverty, that's where most of the population of women in pornography come from. So we're talking about a crime against women in terms of the way the pornography is made, and then, as you know, the way it's used in sexual abuse. And we simply can't say that it's all right. It's not all right. It hurts women. We have legal options. We also have social options. And those social options are important, which is to say, I hope you will keep track of the way that pornography is used in battering of women. It's very important. It's very significant. And you need to talk about it. You need to let people know about it. That will help. But the whole issue here is harm to women and not repression of speech or ideas. Okay? Thank you very much. You've been very, very kind. Thank you.
Okay, Andrea will be over by Bookwoman, if for any additional questions during the break before lunch. I need everybody to clear out as quickly as possible.
Yeah.